Hello and welcome to Game Changers. Happy New Year, world. We are in 2025, and I'm going to shyly suggest we're on season two of Game Changers. So I have got my biggest group of people ever to talk about something that we've touched on in other podcasts, and a couple of people are returning, so I'm super excited about that. We are going to talk about Dragon Age today because it brought up some amazing discussions in previous podcasts that we've had, and now I've got more voices to talk about it. I'm so excited. So my first little bit of housekeeping is I'm going to get everyone that is here, because we've got loads of people contributing today, to introduce themselves. So, Professor Esther, would you like to introduce your lovely self, and also please tell us who your character in Dragon Age tends to be?
Cool. Okay. Hello, everybody. So my name is Esther McCallum-Stewart, and my pronouns are she and her. And I've played most of, but not all of the Dragon Age games. I missed out a bit in the middle. And the character that I'm playing at the moment, or the character that I play in Dragon Age, is called a Mullion. I think she's called at the moment. She's usually called after a herb, and she is a butch presenting female dwarf. So pronouns she and her, but moving towards a sort of quite heavy set character. Obviously, she's a dwarf, she's quite short, she's got a bob. I think she's got a really kind of a mundane prettiness around her. I think she's incredibly attractive looking. And I thought her original version was really attractive looking as well, but she's certainly not traditionally good looking.
I love it. And there is a reason I'm asking everyone to give me an idea about their characters, because there's been a lot of playing of Dragon Age going on. Professor Catherine, would you mind introducing your lovely self and giving us a little bit of insight into who you play in Dragon Age?
Hi, so I'm Catherine Flick, also pronouns she, her. And I am, well, I do technology ethics, particularly video game ethics. And I have been playing Dragon Age ever since the beginning. I used to call it the original one. I used to joke around calling it Dragon Age Oranges because I've misread it as that the first time for some reason. And so it's always been Dragon Age Oranges to me. But I have played many, many, many. Many different many games of Dragon Age multiple times through. I am a massive tragic, and I am totally here for this podcast. My most recent, well, mostly I've played, because I've played many times through, I kind of experiment with different playthroughs. But my default character, I would say, is definitely a Dalish elf. It has the kind of the tree style. She has the tree style face tattoo, Valisleen. I see. I even know the words of these things. I am total tragic. My one in Inquisition was definitely a I can fix it soulless relationship going on. That's my canon Inquisition. Yeah, and so my latest character is very much a no nonsense, like doesn't take any garbage from anybody and wants to get retribution for what has been happening to her world. I always play myself first, like how I would respond, I guess. And then later on, when I do further playthroughs, I tend to then experiment with, I like to do a dark side kind of playthrough.
So, Kirsty, would you mind refreshing the memories?
Hi. So I'm Kirsty. I'm a non-binary person, so I'm they them. And I'm a big Dragon Age fan, and I have been for a very long time. Some of the others said, I've played it a lot since Origins, all the way through every game. I'm also at a point where I have a canon world state. So I have two that I go down. I have a very tragic, nobody gets a good ending world state, which is where all the protagonists, if they can die, will die. All their lovers will die. Everything goes wrong. It's very tragic. It's a hard watch. So that's one of my favorites. And the other one is, I call it the precious metals world state, where I play characters that I get inspired by different materials. So my first character is a Kuzland in Origins, and she's called Bronn, and everything about her is bronzy, and she's kind of brass. And then my hawk is called Silvera, and she's like very silvery white hair. And then you kind of stem from there. The Inquisition is Gul'dana, and then you've got Veilguard, which is Platy, because I couldn't come up with a good platinum name. But that's pretty much my sort of two world states. And at the moment, I'm playing my platinum character, which is Antivan Crawl.
So I had to just unmute there. Can you give us a little bit of an idea about what your character looks like, Kirsty?
Yeah, so they are non-binary in Veilguard. They've been female in every other game, except for when I play male characters. I have a male character in my as a male hawk in my tragic world state. But in my Veilguard playthrough, I'm playing non-binary. And so they're quite androgynous, although now that I've played them for a second time, so I've gone through the game twice, I think the first time I was so fixated on a certain type of look that I made them quite androgynous. But then the second time around, I started incorporating more feminine features because it just felt more natural. It felt more ideal to the character.
That's fab. I was really curious because we've talked about that idea of what a stereotypical non-binary character looks like. And I was super interested. Now we can kind of get a little bit more behind what we can design and how we can present in the game, how you'd interpreted that as this sort of run through. So that's awesome. Last but by no means least, Jamie, can you
Hello.
Introduce yourself?
Yes, I'm Jamie. I have a he, they. In all of the Dragon Age games, all of them, I have played as usually an elf, or not in Dragon Age 2, but as a red-headed elf mage of some description. And that's in all four of the games I've played through. I'm starting to think it's sort of like a family business of just dashing redheads, solving the world's problems, which gives you an insight into how I view myself. But yeah, that's how I play. I usually play as myself. I've talked about this loads where I usually play. I usually play as someone that looks like myself in RPG games, and Dragon Age is no different.
So obviously, this is a audio only medium. We can all see each other, but so there's lots of laughter going on in silent manners on this podcast. But I will just say that Jamie is sat next to me in the studio, and has got the hair, has got everything going for that whole elvish look, and the little earrings. Just only thing missing, points on the ears. That's the
They're
only
a little
thing.
Pointy. They are a tiny bit pointy.
I'm not allowed to say that.
Okay.
There's a really easy way that you can fix that, which is what we used to do in LARP, which is that you can actually, if you put a line of super glue down your ear like that, and then you just pinch it, you can give yourself elf ears and it'll last about 3 hours.
Oh my goodness. I'm getting behind that and recommending.
I know what I'm doing. There's a hardware store nearby. I'm getting the Gorilla Glue. I'm doing it.
Oh my god.
Fun fact
god.
About super glue is it's actually designed to dissolve sweat dissolves it, because it was one of the many things that was invented to go into space. So whilst it sticks lots of things together, it doesn't actually long term stick the body together, even though whenever we get it on our fingers, it's absolutely revolting. So yeah,
I was today years old when I found out. So was Catherine, yeah. And possibly Kirsty.
Yeah, so pro tip,
definitely me and Jamie. Yeah,
pro tip to give yourself pointy ears just briefly.
So what I know, and one of the reasons I've gathered you all here today, is I know that you've all been playing through the most recent version of Dragon Age. And one of the conversations that I think myself and Jamie and Kirsty had, but myself and you, Kirsty, very specifically, was the hope that Dragon Age, this new Dragon Age, was going to offer the opportunity for a lot more kind of less gender specific, forcing you into a box to play a character and giving you some optionality within that. So I would love to talk about that as a starting point, if everyone's okay. And I'd love to start with Kirsty, if that's okay. Primarily because Kirsty, probably out of the four of you, was the most excited about what Dragon Age might offer. Kirsty, you sent me a message. Tell me what the message said, if you can remember. And then give me a bit of information about how you felt when you actually started playing this new version of Dragon Age.
I think I recall our last podcast where we spoke, and I said I had a really good feeling that they were going to do non-binary and trans inclusion, and I had a feeling they were going to do it really well. And at the time I was unsure, but I just sensed it. And then I'm sure I played the game and I sent you a message where I said, it's even better than I hoped, which is exactly how I felt. It was really wonderful to not only see it like played out, it just felt like really natural. It didn't feel forced in. It felt like a genuine experience, and you could tell that, like an afterthought, having done some more research, that it was a non-binary person who had influence in a lot of the writing. So one of the writers, Trick Weeks, they came out as non-binary during the process of creating Veilguard, and their own experiences and influences have clearly like made their way into the game. And I think that sort of genuine inflection has just come across. Like you can definitely see that when you play. That and the fact that they got non-binary voice actors and sort of background actors to work on the game as well. It just feels very genuine.
That's amazing. It was that was exactly what you wrote to me, and you kind of went, oh my gosh, it's so much better than the original. It does exactly what I hoped it would do. It's just so amazing, which is why I wanted to talk about it. Jamie, you've been playing through quite a lot. Haven't got quite as far as Kirsty. Kirsty was saying they've played through twice now.
I have, and I'm kind of glad you called me she by accident, because
I corrected, and I'm going to edit it out to make myself brilliant.
Oh, okay, because I was going to talk about how it's done in the game really well.
I will leave it in then.
I'll very briefly touch on it now. One of the companion characters in the game is a non-binary character, and spoilers, just to go into this, they do eventually come out and they have a scene with another character who we know is very inclusive from previous games. And they accidentally misgender this non-binary character, the character being Tash. And the other character, again, spoilers, is Isabella. So Isabella misgenders Tash in a story where they're just talking about just like past adventures. And when it happens, there's kind of an awkward moment of, oh, ooh, you messed up. And rather than like get really upset about it or be really dramatic about it, they just immediately go, oh, well, I'm going to do some push-ups. To punish myself for it, which is a little bit silly, but you get to talk about it and go, why did you do that, instead of just apologizing? And then they talk about how when you mess up pronouns or you say anything offensive, really, sometimes you get so upset that you've offended someone that you make it all about you. And then they say that the opposite can happen, where if you don't acknowledge it at all, it just seems like you don't care. So it's a really nice thing about how people will genuinely make mistakes. And I'm really glad they added someone being misgendered in the game, because I have family and friends who care about me so deeply, and these accidents happen. And so just to acknowledge them and then pass over them in the game was just, it was a really wonderful thing.
We'll unpack that a little bit more, but I think from what you've said, and as usual, I'm coming in as a person who hasn't played Dragon Age and knows nothing about it and is getting all of the knowledge from you guys. But having a non-binary writer being a key part of the team, something that person will have probably experienced, making its way into the game so that other people who are non-binary or want to experiment with being non-binary within the game can kind of get that real world sensibility and experience and see it reflected, which I think is amazing. Jamie, I know you haven't managed to play all the way through.
No,
yet.
I had hardware issues.
Hardware issues.
They're terrible.
You don't blame me at all, but you know. How have you found it? I think we've discussed before that you're a queer gamer as well as being someone who teaches game and VFX, and so you're kind of looking at it from both sides as someone who plays the games, experiences the games, makes the games as well. How did you find the parts of Dragon Age that you've played through? And most importantly, given what we're sort of talking about right now, how did you find that optionality?
I liked it. I'll talk more about sort of the romantic side of it, because that's the kind of area that I enjoy RPGs for. There's like a lovely assortment of lovely assortment, like they're a Cadbury's box.
So, do they come with a little list?
There's a lovely eclectic gang of people that you can romance in the game. But one of the things I've pointed out previously in other titles, such as Dragon Age Inquisition, is the sort of defined sexualities of your party members. So, for example, in Dragon Age Inquisition, if you don't romance Iron Bull, who is the gigantic beefy man, or Dorian, who is the adorable man with the wizard staff, if you don't romance either of those two, they will get together. So they have an established romantic relationship afterwards that involves it's a queer relationship. And they've done a similar thing in this one, where if you don't romance certain members of your party, in later scenes, those members of those party will get together. One of the things I point to a lot in the research and writing I do is having NPCs and companions have established relationships establishes their sexualities in the world away from the player character, which makes them a more solid representation of who they are within the game world.
Fabulous. That was a very academic answer.
Thank you very much.
Who did you romance?
Who did I romance?
Yeah.
Davron.
Okay. That means nothing to me, but oh, Kirsty has just made a face that indicates approval.
Yes. Yeah. I don't think there is a bad romance in the game. I've the ones that I haven't played, I've watched, and even the quote unquote bad ones, but they're all just beautifully rendered characters. They're all wonderful.
So I'm seeing Catherine nodding away on that beautifully rendered character kind of consideration. How was your playthrough, Catherine? As old guard, if I can say that, you have played, what was it, Dragon Age Oranges? So how have you found it? Obviously, we're looking towards a little bit more of that choice of representation at the moment, but what stood out to you as someone who's really kind of like worked their way through each of the iterations?
Yeah, so I mean, I also romanced Davron because he was irresistible. He's so very attractive, very attractive. Moment. But I have to say though, now that I'm getting on in my years, I found him just a little bit kind of young for me, I guess. And one of the nice things is that there is an older character that you can also romance, which I think is going to be my main target for the next playthrough. So there's an older necromancer called Emmerich, and he is apparently very suave. All the American women that I've talked to who played through all really love the fact that he's got like this British accent. He sounds like he'd take you out for a cup of tea, sort of thing. And it's I'm preparing myself for those sorts of stereotypical Britishness in sort of from an American gaze, I suppose. I did like the fact that there was a real range of different people you could kind of go for. And also just the first few characters you meet, like the first few party characters are all women, or at least, yeah, are all femme. And they're all quite, you know, they've all got their stories. They've all got their things going on, and they're all very different. So, yeah, so I felt like that they definitely they were actually proper full characters. They had their own styles. They weren't just kind of repurposed assets, and it was nice actually to see that, because there's certainly in previous games there's been some characters that were less like they were just there because they were kind of sexy or whatever, and they didn't have much of anything that differentiated them from some of the other characters, right? So
Esther. So you described your character to us. How successful and happy were they in the new Dragon Age?
So I used to give a paper about the original Dragon Age, so I'm going to start there. And it was about early romances, or, you know, romances from sort of 15 or so years ago in video games, and how they were not necessarily particularly, I guess, realistic, right? When Mass Effect was first released, 60 Minutes did a section on it in which they called it the most realistic sex ever. And it's like, oh dear, no, it really isn't. And they've still all got their clothes on. The thing that always used to make me really laugh about Dragon Age in the first game was that all of the female characters had the same bra. They had the same leather bikini bra. But there were all sorts of weird elements like that that were very jarring. And in fact, the first big game romance that I ever had was in Dragon Age. And this is also why I have never finished Dragon Age, because it was a very heterosexual relationship with Alistair, who's sort of, the first person that you meet, and he's this knightly knight, and he's very sweet, and he's very innocent and naive, and he's very shy, and he's got all these kind of hang-ups, and he's a bit of a nerd, and he really likes all the gifts that you give him, because in Dragon Age, the way that you get people to like them, like you, is just giving them gifts until sex falls out. And thank you, Mitu Kandaka, for coining that term, because it is literally what happens. And the thing that I found really jarring that made me rage quit was the fact that you have this very innocent, romantic relationship with Alistair. And then you kiss him for the first time, and it's really quite sexy. And he says, "By the gods, you're beautiful." And he takes you in his arms and he kisses you. And I quite like this. I thought this was pretty cool, and I wanted some more of the kissing. So I went back and I clicked on Alistair to have another kiss. And he said, "Would you like to come to my tent and have sex?" And I quit the game because I was just so disgusted at the inability to continue the plot in a romantic way that it just immediately dissolved to the leather bra scene. And so Dragon Age has always had that mechanic where you give people things to get them to like you. That's part of Dragon Age, and there is more to it. The thing that I found really difficult, and I know I've talked to Jamie and Catherine about this, is having just come straight out of Baldur's Gate, literally walked from Faerûn across the road to Treviso, is the fact that you can have polyamorous relationships with all the Baldur's Gate characters and they do not care about what you're doing with the other characters. Whereas in Dragon Age, you can only have one partner, which meant that I do not have a partner because I don't want to choose, but I don't want to choose between all of my faves. If I'm getting close to one, it's probably Balara. But even then, it's the women rather than the male presenting characters. Wasn't particularly interested in Emmerich at all. Thought Lucanis was, I just didn't talk to him. I just left him in his castle. I was like, I cannot be bothered with you, emo guy. You are the archetype of things that I don't like. And I literally just left him. And there's one point where he comes back for an encounter, because I'm an Antivan Crow as well. He comes back from an encounter, and I think it's like I think there's a funeral or something happening, and you're all standing around. And I was talking to the two NPCs, and I was having a chat with them about, I'm really sorry that I left you because I didn't really want to engage with you, and I did want to engage with the other woman. So I made a completely ludic decision to save her city and not yours. And then this guy turns up and starts talking to you, and I was like, "Who's this?" And it took about 7 or 8 lines of dialogue before I realized it was, oh yeah, he's one of your companions. That's Lucanis. I think also there's a lot to be said for Rook as a character as well. And I've sort of, again, I know I've spoken to Jamie and Catherine about this, but I think Rook themselves is really brilliantly realized. I think they're incredibly charismatic. There's a bit where they just make jokes about feet. They're just walking around this, everybody is nodding. They're just walking around this site that's got this kind of that statue, like that massive statue that you see in Lord of the Rings, that's just like a pair of feet left, and it must have been like Ozymandias at one point. And Rook just starts making these dumb puns, and I was like, I love you, Rook. I think you're so funny. I love their voice acting, which I think is so charismatic. And I think because I'm not ever playing myself, I'm always playing a person in a game, a character in a game. It's funny about what you said earlier, Jamie, about all your, you've got like this generation of redheads. All of my characters have the surname Leafbinder, right? They're all called Leafbinder. They were called Leafbinder in WoW, they were called Leafbinder in Dragon Age. It's not even something that you can input that they're all called Leafbinder. When I was on stage at Worldcon and Chris Perkins got me to play Dungeons and Dragons with him, he misnamed my character because I said my name was Nevaeh, which is my very long-term character. and he gave her a surname. And on stage, straight out, I was like, I think you've got the wrong Nevaeh. My name's Nevaeh Leafbinder. And then afterwards, I just thought, oh my God, I just said that to the lead script writer of Dungeons and Dragons on stage. But I just think, they're really wonderful and kind of very sort of definitive. It's interesting because I said earlier she was kind of butch femme character, but I'm using they pronouns, which is kind of interesting me as I'm doing it. But yeah, so I didn't have a romance, and I feel okay about that actually as well. Like I feel okay that despite the fact that like it's a game with loads of romances in, I was not able to take the polyamory thing, and I understand that that's difficult for game devs. You know, it's just complicated. And I see Kirsty's just like, it works in Baldur's Gate, but they do essentially ignore each other. You know, like there's no, it's you talking to them and then talking to another one and then talking to another one. They don't really, you know. But interestingly, I kind of felt the next best option was maybe kind of sort of a level of aceness, I guess. Yeah, it was interesting. And I don't regret not going down the line with one of them either. So, yeah.
I wanted to jump in quickly on the points you were making about like the writing of the characters and sort of the impressions you got off of Rook themselves, because I wanted to point that it's not too big of a complaint. It's a little bit of a complaint where in the new in Dragon Age Veilguard, they've definitely taken a turn away from the previous Dragon Age games where everyone's a bit more positive and nice. Everyone's very happy. And there's not a level of sort of darkness. I'll say darkness to the characters because everyone's kind of bright and shiny, which I'm going to reveal too much about myself here, but made me less interested in romancing any of them. So for like in Dragon Age Inquisition, Dorian Parvus, who is my husband, has this sort of like he's a queer person who's dealt with like issues. He's got like a little bit of darkness to him, and he's got like a bit of sass, and he's got like a sort of more angrier side to him, and that depth of character really brought him together as like one package for me, and I really like that. It's the same over in Baldur's Gate, where like even the really goody two-shoes characters, like the 7-foot-tall druid man Halsin, has a sort of dark side to him, or sort of a nebulous grey area to him that made him more interesting as a character. It's something I wanted to point to because sometimes in RPGs, and on that topic of choice we're talking about, I much prefer RPGs where you play as a blank slate character, often interacting with more morally grey characters. Esther, you pointed to the fact that Rook has a lot of personality to them. I like that, but if I was playing an RPG and I wanted to play more as myself, like sometimes I want to play more of like a serious version of myself, and I didn't really get the choice in that. Like I got sort of railroaded into being, even like when I was picking choices of like narrative and dialogue, I was always, every time I'd pick something, it would always have like a positive twinge to it. So I felt kind of like, okay, I'm playing as a traditional good guy, but sometimes that's not me. Sometimes I want to be sort of more edgy and I want to hang around with some more edgy characters and do some more morally dubious things. And my God, I hope this never comes up in court. But that's like an actual choice I want to point to.
And I think it's interesting because, again, like you can't not compare this to BG3. But BG3 really wants you to play Dark Urge, right? It really, really wants you to take that pathway and to experiment with being as horrible and awful as you can. And there is a lot of plot there in order for you to do it. And I think it's a really interesting development decision by the Dragon Age people to, as you say, go in the opposite direction. Like the grime is, you know, like as you were talking, I'm thinking, I really like Balara, but one of the things that I don't like about her is like, why are you adventuring, you sweet piece of fluff? Like you are not cut out for this. It's gonna crush you like a bug. And yet you're still here. And I think actually, yeah, you're making it, it's a good point.
Catherine, you had something to say before Jamie so abruptly jumped in on Rook.
I asked you previously.
It's okay, Jamie, I forgive you. I actually forgot what I was going to say then, but I want to talk about this kind of this more upward trend of like positivity. And I think it's been something that's been kind of criticized across the board generally from what I've seen in the reviews, and that is that it is a lot more positive. But I think that the Jamie's issue with the not being able to be yourself sort of thing has always been an issue with Dragon Age. They've always put things into your, they've always had the kind of the summary, you know, you get the like the arms crossed option, you get the snarky option, and you get the, I don't know, the whatever, like there's a couple of other options you can get, right? But all of them, yeah, it's like, yeah, thumbs up, thumbs down, power fist, you know, like all this sort of stuff, right? And but the they've always had a Esther is in the corner of my eye, she's imitating all of these potential options you have. But anyway, the issue that we have with those is that they're always summaries, right? You always get a summary of what they're going to say, but you don't, it doesn't actually tell you the tone of what they're going to say. And I think that that's actually, that can feel quite, it breaks that immersion. And I think that that can feel, I mean, it's obviously it's a design, it's a narrative choice. I mean, people who, the writers who are writing Rook as the character are playing their own version of Rook, right? And as they're doing that writing. And so it's a choice that they're making. And I think it's partly because I worry that I'm a little, I mean, this is all kind of probably like writing by committee, a little bit of it, right? Where you have lots of, you have a big team of writers, which they did for this, and, you know, you're told to go off and write this bit, and it needs to kind of fit into this very large jigsaw puzzle of everybody else's writing. And if you sort of start doing stuff that's kind of out of character, let's just say, from the rest of the writing, it can make it really difficult to kind of get the tone right. So I wonder if what they did is they kind of erred towards this general positivity trend as a kind of decision to make everybody else's, all the writers' lives a bit easier than it was about the actual, like, whether there should be a dark side of Rook that needed to be explored, right? And I sort of see this as a little bit of a, you know, it's this kind of the fact that these games are so large now, you need so many writers, you have this kind of you need to have some sort of overall control over what the tone is, and so it will tend towards a kind of neutral but vaguely positive thing that is not offensive to anyone.
I want to just like kind of jump in there and say, like, I think we have to kind of acknowledge that during the writing of Veilguard, Dragon Age had a lot of cutoffs of its writing staff, and it lost a lot of writing staff on the way. And also that the story changed maybe 3 or 4 times, initially from single player to MMO, back to single player, with multiple different sort of variations. You're shaking your head. Am I mistaken? No. Okay. Just disapproval.
No, it's a shake your head of I can't believe they did that, because that's, yeah, like what were they thinking? That's more a shake of head. Yep.
If anyone's listening and I'm completely wrong, I think I'm right. I'm pretty sure that because I've got the art book and they talk about the different titles that they had for each sort of theme that they were going for. And they changed a lot, and it definitely feels like they didn't know what they wanted to do with Veilguard. The only thing they did know, and this kind of circles back to what we were talking about characters being potentially evil or morally grey, is that they wanted Solas to be one of the baddies from the game. And I kind of say the term baddie loosely, because he's not good by any means. He's still the antagonist, although I don't think it's spoilers at this point. There are other antagonists, but he is still one of them. And he is written very well. So Trick Weeks writes Solas. And maybe I'm a Weeks fan for multiple reasons, but I think Solas is one of those characters who is just written phenomenally well, both in Inquisition and in Veilguard. Straight down to the ending, and I know not everyone here has finished the game, so I won't spoil the ending, but there are multiple different endings that involve Solas, and you can have a very evil Solas ending that has some wonderful writing, just amazing writing, kind of tells us a lot about his character and his actual thoughts, He's a character who says a lot throughout previous games that no god would have to self-declare themselves as a god. And he's very, very proud. Like, his whole thing is pride. Solus means pride. He's a very proud person. And then one of his last lines can be, "I am a god," which is just so telling about his character. And it seems kind of weird out of context, but I promise if you play the game and you go down that route, there are multiple routes that could lead you away from that. Getting that line is just a wonderful ending line from him. You can summarize what happens to him after he says that. But it's a very nice sort of thing that happens. So I think he's written just great. And I think the thing that makes him so great is that he was a character from previous games and he was set in stone. And so they could develop him further in this game. But I don't actually think that's fully the reason, because there are other characters from previous games like Varric, Isabella, Dorian, and someone else who I can't seem to think of. Morrigan, she's also in the game. And because they have so many choices in previous games that can change who they are as a person, they're written so badly in this one. And that's probably my biggest grievance. I think the game's written really well and it has some beautiful scenes and beautiful characters. I would even jump back to say that I romanced Lucanus and I think he is wonderful. So how dare you comment about my husband that way? But then back to this idea of, because there's so many choices in previous games, they've written previous characters in a very vague way. They haven't given them any of the choices. And so Morrigan, who's known to be quite an antagonistic character and say some very fun lines, is just a blank slate. Like, she's not catty. She doesn't have anything fun to say. Dorian, he has his, like, the voice actors do wonderfully great work, but the lines don't tell me anything about what I did to the characters. And I think one of the most upsetting ones for me was definitely Morrigan, because, like, she has my child and she doesn't even mention him. And that's such a big storyline. So it's a very unfortunate thing they did by wanting to do fan service and bring in cameos, but having to write them very, very plainly to not imply choices. And I can see that Jamie kind of wants to jump in on that. So I'll throw back to him.
I was going to jump in on that. Firstly, to say it's great that they've written some great stuff for Solus. However, I've been waiting a decade to fold that man like a pancake and throw him through a window. So I'm not super enthused about the effort put in there. But I'll add to your point you've just made as well about the companions popping back and they're not really fulfilling like that the satisfaction you want from them. Because obviously, like, I've spent under 20 odd hours with Dorian and with Isabella and that kind of thing, and like some of the things that they do and sit in the story don't make a super amount of sense. So the scene Esther was talking about earlier was a midway through the start of the first few hours of the game. You get given the choice between saving two cities like Treviso or the other ones you started. I can't remember the name, Dorian, from my playthrough of Inquisition, is sat in one of those cities, right? And me and Dorian, that there's a city, they're both being attacked by big dragons, big scary dragons, right? But I know for a fact that my Dorian from Inquisition has killed about 12 dragons with me. And I'm like, I go into that fight thinking, oh, maybe Dorian will turn up because, you know, this is his expertise at this point. But no, he's sat in a pub, just having a drink. Like, in most scenes, he's just like, you'll sort it, Rook. Off you go. Don't worry about it. There's a general sense from all of those characters of, like, we already saved the world once. Like, don't worry about it. Like, you go and do it. We'll just sit here and advise. It really does. It strikes a weird chord with me.
In my playthrough, I thought that the other city would be fine because Dorian was there. So I picked the other city. So I was like, oh, Dorian's got this sorted. He can go kill a bunch of dragons. He was my best bud in the previous games. And I know he can, like, single, he's like top level ice magic or something. He'll be fine. Like, no, I was sorely up, very, very upset about that. Yeah.
I think this is kind of a good place to jump in with the idea that these characters, like in different cities, like characters from previous games that should have been in these games but aren't. And there's always this big discussion about your warden from Dragon Age Origins, if they've survived Origins and Awakening. The question is kind of, why are they just letting all these like world disasters happen and just going, well, I've done my bit, and that's them. They kind of, as a writing thing, came up with this excuse that, oh, your warden's trying to cure the taint, so they're investigating Darkspawn, and that's a really big job. But the art book from this and Veilguard, that is, and Inquisition, shows that they've tried multiple times to have your warden come back into the game, and they just haven't been able to do it. Including the warden commander from this game, that was supposed to be your warden. And potentially, there's a character of Stroud in Inquisition who has a really important scene with Hawk. In fact, that game's been out so long, I'll say it. It's where you choose Hawk or the Warden to stay in the Fade. And the Warden can be Alistair, Loghain, or Stroud, depending on choices. But it was supposed to be your Warden instead of Stroud. And that would have been so much more impactful. And because it was a voiceless protagonist and some issues, they've always stayed away from it. And I feel like they've definitely missed a trick by just letting us imagine that our characters are letting disasters happen, but not actually do anything about it. We're just letting all this stuff happen. And to fix that with this one, and they did it with Inquisition too by bringing Hawk in. I think when they did it in Inquisition, they did Hawk very well because Hawk's already pre-written, and they have a lot of character, much like Rook has. Whereas the Inquisitor is a lot more flexible. And when the Inquisitor comes into this game to help you, spoilers for anyone who didn't know that the Inquisitor shows up, you do design them at the very start of the game, so it's heavily implied. They come in very that you don't even get a chance to pick. So when Hawk comes in Inquisition, you can pick either Diplomatic Hawk, Humorous Hawk, or Aggressive Hawk. Whereas when your Inquisitor comes in, they are just the Inquisitor. And mine didn't feel like my Inquisitor. And I think the biggest thing that I'll touch on with that before I pass on to anyone else to talk about unusual writing choices is quite a large spoiler, but I think something that everybody's already assumed is that your Inquisitor, if they've romanced Solas, can end up with Solas. But it's not so much that they can end up with Solas, it's they don't really confront Solas. They just like they get over it real quick all of a sudden, and like she just goes off with him. She's like, oh, you almost ended the world several times. You lied to me for 12 years. You're the reason I don't have an arm. I'm not going to address any of that. Let's just run off together. Like, I did want them to end up together, but you could have at least confronted them a little bit, just a little bit.
That's the kind of red flag dodging I'm going for. I do want to I want to jump in on that. I do want to say first, if anyone from BioWare's listening in, I do we do understand it's difficult. Like, we are game devs. We get you. But I wanted to add, like, in the same vein, like, there's a scene with the Inquisitor and there's a scene with Dorian. Both scenes are in the same geographical location, and at no point do they meet up. Like, they could have had a little kiss. They could have seen, because I've been waiting 10 years to see the continuation of my sort of. They do this lovely heartbreaking thing at the end of Inquisition, where you get a whole bunch of information about what happens afterwards, and one of them is if you're romancing Dorian, he goes back to his home country to become like a magister. And like help run the country and try and make it better, which is really, really sweet. And there's this whole thing where he makes these or finds these sending stones, so the Inquisitor and Dorian can remain in like constant contact. He essentially invents the telephone, and the first ever long distance relationship. And it's a sweet and adorable, and it doesn't come up. And I'm disappointed. Again, I understand. Games of these magnitudes are really, really difficult. And obviously, BioWare did the same with the Mass Effect trilogy. And like the three Mass Effect games link together really well, but they were written together, and they're all one self-contained thing. But the Dragon Age ones are a lot more sporadic. So from like a game development perspective, I understand why these things have changed or been like essentially compromised. It just creates a very jarring feeling for somebody who like I was, how old was I when Inquisition came out? I was 14, and I was just becoming. I was just figuring out how to be queer, and Dorian was like a big part of that, because he was like the first fully interactable written queer character. Thank you, David Gaylor, for all your work on him. And he was very formative and very like I related to him a lot. And I didn't get that from this one, but I imagine there'll be people out there who are playing a Dragon Age game for the first time who might latch onto one of the companion characters in the same way that I did. I am hopeful. Oh no, I've become positive that Veil Guard has infected me.
I think that's a good point though, and like it kind of goes back to what you said at the beginning there. We love games, and there are things in games that we really love, and actually there are things that these games do really, really, like they just do really well. And that for all the kind of, it's funny. So there's a theory in romance literature, which is very prevalent in current romance writing, particularly in queer writing, which instead of having a happily ever after, an HEA, you have a happy for now. And a lot of writers tend to actually end on that because you can be happy right now, but it's unrealistic to be like, you know, and then the Heartstopper characters, right? Then they looked into each other's eyes forever, and they remained like that forever and ever and ever, and they became old men together, and you know, the end. Like, yes, it's nice to think, but actually we're quite realistic, and we sort of know that that doesn't happen. And it's interesting listening to everybody talking about their previous relationships and how they sort of wanted them to be enacted in the game. There's a kind of like, we all know that the relationships that we had with those characters were unique, but we still want to see them in a game. it's a real conundrum. And it's like, you know, there's this sort of yearning for something that's not really there, but there's also an understanding that something is good, but perhaps what is there is not quite. I mean, Kirsty, I thought Morrigan just turns up and then she F's off again. And you're like, and I was like, I remember you. And there's a bit where you can overhear two NPCs, and one of them says something like, "I don't know what to make about Morrigan," and I'm like, 20 years ago she would have I can just imagine her turning around, and as you say, like, you know, absolutely scathing bite back on that NPC. But yeah, I think we want something that we can't have, and we recognize that we can't have it, but at the same time we still want to have it, you know. So we want to know that our happy for now is still quite happy, basically.
Can I just bring up something that I think they did do well, because I think we got some space for that, right? And I think that, I mean, one of the things they obviously wanted to do was have, you know, an egg story, right? They wanted a trans story. And I think that there's a lot of critique. I mean, obviously it's not my community, but I've read a bit of discussion around this, and it seems that, you know, in terms of the trans representation, I mean, obviously there was some in previous, in Inquisition, for example, there was the first trans character. And what I really liked in Veil Guard was that there was this whole kind of story about the coming out of Tash. Sorry, spoilers, but, you know, it's been pretty well written about these days. And there was, but also there were a bunch of just other, like, queer characters and particularly non-binary characters who just existed in the world. And, like, for example, for those who haven't played through, the Governor of Treviso, I think, is non-binary, and they're just noted by their pronouns. But nothing is ever... it's not a thing, like, nobody, like, the only thing that is mentioned is that, like, they just talk about them as they, them, right? And so it's nice to have those, just, like, one of the things that I've done a lot of work sitting in at the Diversity Lounge at PAX East and talking to a lot of queer people about what they like about games, and one of the things that consistently comes up is just representation, just like the diversity in games needs to be better, right? And one of the things that I think they really try very hard with in the Dragon Age series is to especially in the last couple of games, is to do that and do that reasonably well. And you know, Kirsty was talking about the writers before, as writers of Tash, and that you know, that was written. The other thing also is obviously, you know, like no representation without us, right? So there's like that sort of classic conundrum of, can you write outside of your own experiences? And so I think it's also really good that they've brought in, like, they have people who have those experiences writing these characters rather than doing it from an external kind of perspective. And I mean, you know, there's always going to be flaws with the writings of these characters, and it's not always going to be everybody's story. But like, I like to see, like, over a long time, we've seen women, like female characters, being better written, better represented, and more women actually writing these characters. And they have gotten a lot better. And what I'm starting to see now is the kind of the beginnings of that for these other communities. And I think that that's so much better. And I hope that people keep doing it, even if they do get some criticism for doing it, because, yeah, it's so important to do that.
Yeah, and I know this isn't the focus of this particular podcast, but I think the other thing is that there are so many different colours in this game. You know, like, I've seen several of my friends saying, you know, they're so excited about the fact that black hair isn't, it's not just one black hair, and the black hair really, really works. But I also get a real sense that the black characters aren't white personas with a black skin either. You know, they feel like they are, again, outside of my ability to actually say this, but they do feel like they are much closer to people of colour's lived experience than again, you know, things that we've seen before where it's like, oh, well, this character is black, but the experiences that they have are of privilege, and they just jar, you know, they don't make sense. And there seems to be a real, not just a sort of real effort there, but it's really nice. I've completely blanked. Neve, it is Neve, isn't it? Of course it's Neve, because it's really confusing because my main is usually called Neve. But I love the fact that Neve has a sort of Slavic Indian face and demeanor, very indeterminate in a really positive way, and also a disability, which is just never mentioned, because why would it be? It doesn't add anything to be like, oh, and by the way, you only have one leg. It's, you know, again, that discussion, it's like the same discussion of like, oh, look, you over there, non-binary person. Yes, I am indeed a non-binary person, and here I am to be non-binary at you. And it's like, it just feels, the world feels more robust as a result. It feels like it's got people in it. It doesn't feel like it's got the non-binary character in it, you know, or the trans person in it. It's such a relief. I'd not got that far with Tasha, although obviously kind of knew that, but there's the discussions that they're having with their mother in the early scenes where they're just being made to feel awkward by their mum. They're so human. It's just a really nice piece of character building that's got not very much to do with their transness. Probably it will do later, but that's only if you're looking at it, knowing what you're looking for. But it's just this sort of, you know, you've got all this legacy and we expect you to do this and we expect you to eat your meal like this. It's like, don't get down from the table, Tash. You need to finish the conversation. It's like this person is an adult, as far as I can tell.
There's a lot of really interesting interaction between the player and the player's identity and Tash and Tash's identity, because one of the things I liked is Tash's identity when it comes to gender nonconformity is linked into Tash's sort of internal debate over what kind of nationality or culture they draw from, because they are a Kunari whose mother follows the Kun, which is like Kunari culture, but they've been raised on like it's near Treviso, or it's sort of like in a sort of pirate kind of culture of like treasure hunters. And Tash is in this constant battle between the two, and that also brings into like their into question their concept of gender, because the Kun has very sort of squared away sort of ideals around gender, and then the other culture has different views on gender. One of the things I liked is there's some writing in the game about how different cultures treat gender and the concepts of third genders, which resounded a lot with me, because when I talk about gender identity, the concept of multiple gender outside of the binary concept of gender, I often refer back to things like real world examples, like the first examples of third genders coming from Mesopotamia and from Native American culture and from Indian culture pre-colonization, where you can look at it and go, these cultures who never interacted all have this concept of a third gender, which then gives our modern day concept of a third gender a bit more backing, because we can turn around to people who say, oh, this is all modern wokeness, and go, actually, no, it's a concept that's been within human history for a very long time.
I've got a student working on representations of drag in the Philippines at the moment, where, again, very, very specific, deliberate medicine person is a gender, basically. Again, this is a poor reading of what they've told me, so I do apologize to anybody that I'm just getting this really, really wrong about. But yeah, their description of it to me was that basically sort of shamanic druidic peoples were considered outside of gender because they're healers, and healers don't have gender, which is really, really, what an interesting third gender to have, healer. Like, really fascinating. So yeah, sorry, Kirsty, I saw you were gonna...
Yeah, I'm just, I, it's so many like topics and thoughts on the matter that my brain's running wild, and I know we only have like a set amount of time. So there's a few things I really, really want to talk about. And it's in relation to something Jamie just said about Tasha's culture, sort of making them think about who they are. And as a non-binary person, but surely not the spokesperson for non-binary people by any means, that was the only element of Tasha's story that I didn't like. I think Tasha's written wonderfully. I love everything about them. I actually initially, when I met them and they had that sort of almost adolescent feel, like you said, like their mother very much bosses them about. They're definitely in their 20s, they're very young. That kind of put me off at first, and then the more I sort of played and realized their sort of age range and understood them, I began to really love them. I love everything about them. The only thing I don't really like is that we make such a point with Tasha's character. There's a wonderful moment where they come out to you, that I kind of experienced myself at one point, where you can walk in as a non-binary root and you've got Nev there talking to Tash, and Tash says something along the lines of, why do you dress like a woman? Does your mother make you? And then Nev says, why? No, of course, I dress the way I want to because I'm a beautiful woman. And then you can, someone asks Tash, do you like being a woman? And Tash says, nobody likes being a woman. Which, out of context, can seem so offensive, but in reality, it's that idea of the character has no understanding that anybody would want to be a woman, because they feel so outside of that binary, like, and they can't tell if they're more masculine or more feminine, and then eventually they say they'll figure it out and then choose non-binary. And that's wonderful, because it shows that they didn't feel like they could fit either as a man or a woman, and they've picked something in between. And then when it comes to their culture, you have to choose for them by encouraging them. Does Tash become more Ravaini, or does Tash become more Kunari? And there's no third option. So they just immediately beeline you into this binary option about culture, when the whole character is about not having to pick between two things. And so suddenly it's like, yes, I'm Tash, because I picked a Ravaini because it's the more sort of open culture, or led to believe, than Kunari. And they say, like, yes, I'm Tash and I'm a Ravaini. And I think they say, and also a little Kunari. But they kind of just go, nope, I'm Ravaini now. Or you can pick the other version, which is, I'm Kunari now. And that's such a, like, it feels so disingenuous to what the whole character is about. I think a lot of their characters should have been about embracing being multiple ethnicities and multicultural and sort of go down that route.
I think there's maybe a bit of a conflicting storyline here, because again, having not seen that part of the story, the thing that really strikes me, because it happens twice in dialogue, is that when you are asking Tash about being a pirate, they basically say, "I'm a pirate, but only when the other people were very, very bad." Because it's like, sorry, you managed to decide that the things that you stole were appropriative or not? And like, there's a whole kind of stuff about like repatriating some of this stuff. And it's like, how do you know, Tash?
This leads into the point I made earlier about everything being bright and shiny and positive, because there's certain aspects of like the Dragon Age lore that have translated, like, so the previous games were really dark and gritty, right? In Origins, you meet a fella called Zevran, who is a an assassin from the same place as I've forgotten the name of the place, but you meet the same guild of assassins in this one, and they're all really like positive and family, and like, we defend Treviso, they defend Treviso, they're the military of Treviso, they're quite honorable. And in Zevran, when you meet Zevran, he's like, he fails to assassinate you in Origins, and he goes, right, I can't go back, because if I go back, I've failed in my job, so I will be killed. There's this like kind of sort of weird shift, and it's the same with the piracy stuff as well, because they're sort of themed as pirates, but they're sort of the sort of Disney Channel pirates, where it's like, we only take the plunder that we're allowed to take, you know, morally. And it's like, but you're pirates, you're covered in gold, you can't have got all of that legitimately, come on.
I'll very quickly sort of say that there are head canons and fanons that kind of summarize both those issues. The Zevran one being that since Origins, he's worked to assassinate all the evil Antiven crows, and he has said that he's trying to take them down in multiple pieces of Codex. So the impression you can take is that he got rid of all the bad ones and only the good ones are left. And as for the Lords of Fortune, the Pirate Guild, Isabella learns a very harsh lesson in Dragon Age 2 by taking a religious relic from the Qunari, and she almost dies because of it, or she can get kidnapped, but we don't talk about that in Veilguard for some reason, that just never gets mentioned, but she can get kidnapped because of it, and she learns this hard lesson. So we kind of believe that because she's the head of the Lord of Fortune, she's become very much, it belongs in a museum, because she doesn't want to get kidnapped again for taking something that doesn't belong to her and is appropriated. And I think that's a really good way to fill in those blanks that hadn't maybe been thought about.
I love it. So we've reached the end of our kind of conversation, just in as much as the memory on Esther's computer is finite, and therefore we will soon run out of time. But I don't think the conversation's finished by any means. It sounds like a fascinating game, but also one that started to make a good few changes, which are really positive in terms of representing different players, how they want to be shown within a game and how they want to experience a game as well. And I think that if we bring it back and we think about female characters, non-binary characters, being able to explore and kind of experiment with interactions and relationships, it sounds very much like they've made some really good steps in the game to actually facilitate that and have that happen. That just leaves me to thank all of my panelists, all of my guests. Yeah, James doing a pirate dance. I'm going to call you guests. Yeah, thank you so much, everyone. I hope you've kind of enjoyed it. I hope you found some interesting points to talk about, and hopefully I can ask you all to be guests again when we talk about something as interesting as this.